Hi, I'm Martha Nussbaum. I'm just going to briefly welcome everyone on behalf of the Dewey Committee, then turn it over to my colleague Bernard Harcourt, who will do the extended introduction of Professor Rorty. But just to say that this Dewey Lecture is an annual event. We always try to have someone in the philosophical range of things, and the first one of these was given by John Rawls, in fact, and became a very famous published paper called The Idea of Public Reason Revisited, and we've had a very distinguished series, but we're absolutely thrilled that we can add to it a lecture by Professor Rorty, whom we've wanted to get for a long time, and I'm very glad I told him now that this turnout is better than most of the distinguished people who've given it. So we will have the introduction and then the lecture, and then there will be about a half hour for questions from the floor, and then you're all invited to a reception that will be in the corridor outside where more informal discussion can continue. But now I'll turn things over to Bernard Harcourt, Professor of Law, who will introduce Professor Rorty.
Richard Rorty introduces his work in philosophy and social hope in these terms. Most of what I have written in the last decade consists of attempts to tie in my social hopes, hopes for a global, cosmopolitan, democratic, egalitarian, classless, casteless society with my antagonisms towards Platonism. These attempts have been encouraged by the thought that the same hopes and the same antagonisms lay behind many of the writings of my principal philosophical hero, John Dewey. John Dewey, Richard Rorty explains, is the philosopher whom I most admire and of whom I should most like to think of myself as a disciple. If the world were a perfect place and we could magically choose the person who is most perfectly suited in the entire universe to give the Dewey Lecture on Law and Philosophy, and there were no constraints, no transaction costs, no risks of rejection, no scheduling conflicts, we would choose Professor Richard Rorty. Unfortunately, the world isn't a perfect place, but it is right here and right now, and in the next hour and a half at the University of Chicago. Since well before the publication of Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature in 1979, Richard Rorty has been one of the leading philosophical thinkers of our time. He has moved philosophical discourse in new directions, helping to produce, borrowing a term from perhaps a soulmate, Thomas Kuhn, a paradigm shift in philosophy toward what may be called post-philosophical thinking. Richard Rorty is, among other things, the world's leading student of John Dewey, but as with most world historic philosophical thinkers, his relationship to Dewey is just a prolegomenon to the development of his own unique and brilliant thought. For Professor Rorty, one of Dewey's main accomplishments was, in his own words, negative. Dewey showed us how to get rid of what Richard Rorty calls the intellectual baggage which we inherited from the Platonic tradition. But to move forward, Professor Rorty argues, we must rely on what he calls Dewey the prophet rather than Dewey the pragmatist philosopher. This is the Dewey who was wedded to a more romantic ideal of human and moral progress. It is here, of course, that other pragmatists differ, and one of these is our own Judge Richard Posner, whose work Richard Rorty will be addressing today. And as many of you know, in this regard, Professor Rorty is not writing on a blank slate. He has written extensively about Judge Posner's views and the use of pragmatist thought in law, and Judge Posner has written extensively on Professor Rorty and his form of pragmatism. Now, being at Chicago, where ideas matter, I think it's only fair to say that Rorty and Posner do not see eye to eye. I think it's important to set the stage properly. Judge Posner has criticized Professor Rorty's pragmatism in law as a form of judicial Don Quixotism. In his book, Law, Pragmatism, and Democracy, in 2003, Judge Posner writes, Rorty's advocacy of what appears to be a specific pragmatic philosophy of adjudication, namely a visionary mode of judicial decision-making, owes little that I can see to pragmatic philosophy, and will simply frighten judges for whom visionary is not part of the job description. Dewey, Rorty, Posner, great thinkers who claim the mantle of pragmatism. Where does this all take us? I, for one, and I know everyone else in this room, is thrilled and honored to be here for the continuation of this remarkable conversation. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome back home to the University of Chicago, Professor Richard Rorty.
Thank you very much, Professor Harcourt. I was honored by Dean Levmore's invitation to give this lecture, and I'm always very happy to have an occasion to revisit the scenes of my adolescence. I matriculated in the so-called Hutchins College in 1946 and left with an MA in 1952. Those were the six richest and most stimulating years of my intellectual life, and I owe the University of Chicago an enormous debt. When I came to Chicago, John Dewey was still alive, but his influence had long since peaked. In those days, the best students in the university were sitting at the feet of Leo Strauss, who taught them that Plato had been magnificently right and Dewey dangerously wrong. Utility and truth, Strauss wrote, are two entirely different things. In recent decades, pragmatism has emerged from the shadows. Among those who have done the most to revive it is Richard Posner. I've learned a great deal from Judge Posner's books, and our philosophical outlook is pretty much the same, but we still disagree on certain issues. I'm going to use this lecture to explain why I think that on some of those issues, Dewey would have been on my side. Strauss wasn't the first German to be dismissive about pragmatism. Georg Simmel described it as what the Americans were able to get out of Nietzsche. Simmel was wrong if he thought that James and Dewey got ideas from Nietzsche, but he was right to see their views as overlapping with his. To my mind, the most important area of overlap is their opposition to positivism, to the idea that physical science can answer metaphysical questions by discovering the intrinsic nature of reality. All three philosophers, James, Dewey, and Nietzsche, wanted us to stop asking such questions, but James and Dewey did better than Nietzsche at formulating a coherent anti-metaphysical view. That's because they were never tempted to adopt Nietzsche's dry, aloof, condescending attitude toward human beings' struggle for happiness. Instead, the pragmatists urged that we judge all philosophical views, including their own, by whether they aided in that struggle. They thereby achieved a consistency that Nietzsche never managed. Nietzsche is notorious for his vacillations. He wavers between criticizing the very idea of objective truth and proclaiming that his own views are objectively true and everybody else is objectively false. On one page, he tells us, I quote, "We simply lack any organ for knowledge, for truth. We know or believe or imagine just as much as may be useful in the interests of the human herd." But a few pages earlier in The Gay Science, he wrote, quote, "Even we, godless anti-metaphysicians, still take our fire, too, from the flame lit by a faith that is thousands of years old, the faith of Plato that truth is divine." At his best, however, Nietzsche explicitly rejected the sort of science worship that links much of 21st century analytic philosophy to 19th century positivism. When Nietzsche says there are no facts, only interpretations, and seems willing to admit that that goes for his own assertions as well, he's edging closer to the more coherent position that James and Dewey adopted. Both pragmatists would have agreed with him that, quote, "A scientific interpretation of the world might therefore still be one of the most stupid of all possible interpretations, one of the poorest in meaning." Unfortunately, however, passages like that one are offset by bursts of positivistic braggadocio, as when Nietzsche writes, I quote, still the gay science, "Long live physics, and even more so that which compels us to turn to physics, our honesty." The best thing about pragmatism is that it does consistently what Nietzsche did only occasionally and half-heartedly. It abandons positivism's attempt to elevate science above the rest of culture. It rejects the quarrel between Platonic immaterialism and Democritean materialism and all other metaphysical disputes because they are irrelevant to practice. Pragmatists substitute the question, which descriptions of the human situation are most useful for which human purposes, for the question, which description tells us what that situation really is. Pragmatism thus puts natural science on all fours with politics and art. It treats science as one more source of suggestions about what we human beings might do with ourselves. We might, for example, colonize the planets of other stars, or we might tweak our genes in order to give birth to Übermenschen. But we might instead try to equalize the life chances of rich children and poor children. Or we might try to make our lives into works of art. Philosophers, Dewey thought, should consider the relative merits of such proposals. But they should not try to ground a choice between them on knowledge of what human beings really are. For, as Dewey said, I quote, "The term reality is a term of value or choice. Philosophy," he concluded, I quote again, "is not in any sense whatever a form of knowledge. It is rather," quote, "a social hope reduced to a working program of action, a prophecy of the future." If you agree with Dewey, as I do, about what philosophy is good for, you will see contemporary philosophy in the English-speaking world as a contest between the heirs of Kant and the heirs of Hegel. Present-day neo-Kantians try to grasp the human situation and to practice moral philosophy without reference to history. The neo-Hegelians, on the other hand, hope to grasp the present historical moment in thought in order to formulate better prophecies of better futures. Dewey praised Hegel for having recognized that, as Dewey put it, quote, "the moral consciousness of the individual is but a phase in the process of social organization." Dewey thought that the way to do moral philosophy was to compare alternative programs of action and alternative prophecies. But among present-day fans of Dewey, there is still plenty of disagreement about what programs of action follow from his pragmatist philosophy. Cheryl Misak and Robert Westbrook, for example, claim that Dewey argued successfully from a pragmatist view of truth and knowledge to the need for deliberative democracy. Misak urges that a pragmatist approach to knowledge provides argumentative ammunition against, for example, fascists and religious fundamentalists. Westbrook says, quote, "Pragmatist epistemology alone is enough to provide grounds for criticism of those who refuse to open themselves to the widest possible range of experience and argument," and then claims that deliberative democracy is the only form of government that provides the maximum amount of openness. Judge Posner and I do not think that pragmatist epistemology is up to the jobs that Misak and Westbrook think it can perform. Westbrook ruefully notes, I quote, "No pragmatist has worked harder to break the link between pragmatism and deliberative democracy than Richard Posner." I agree with Posner when he writes, quote, "The bridge Dewey tried to build between epistemic and political democracy is too flimsy to carry heavy traffic." Dewey's attempts to build that bridge were, I think, half-hearted and spasmodic. As long as he defined democracy merely as, quote, "a name for a life of free and enriching communion," it was easy for him to argue that the cause of democracy might be assisted if we abandoned both metaphysics and the correspondence theory of truth. One can agree, but it is a long way from recommending such a life to the claim that the masses should have a larger role in forming public policy. One can agree wholeheartedly with Dewey about the nature of truth, knowledge, and inquiry, and nevertheless believe that what Posner describes as, quote, "our present system of elective aristocracy is the best form of government we can hope for. But though Posner and I agree on this point, we disagree about another deeper issue. We both think that Hegel and Dewey were right to view the moral consciousness of the individual as a matter of internalized social norms, but we disagree about whether our norms are better than those of our ancestors. Posner rejects the idea that we have made moral progress. I think that at that point he is relapsing from the true Deweyan faith into positivistic science worship. Toward the beginning of his book, The Problematics of Moral and Legal Theory, Posner defines morality as, quote, the set of duties to others that are supposed to check our merely self-interested emotional or sentimental reactions to serious questions of human conduct. He goes on to say, quote, the genuineness of morality as a system of social control is not in question, but, he argues, since systems of social control are obviously local, so are moralities. Posner admits that, quote, there are a handful of rudimentary principles of social cooperation, such as don't lie all the time, that may be common to all human societies. But these, he says, quote, are too abstract to be criterial. To get guides to action, genuine checks to self-interest, you need thicker notions than those used to state such principles. As Posner says, quote, what counts as murder or as bribery varies enormously from society to society. So he continues, quote, meaningful moral realism is out and a form of moral relativism is in. Moral principles that claim universality can usually be better understood as just the fancy dress of workaday social norms that vary from society to society, close quote. Up to this point, Posner and Dewey are pretty much in accord. Dewey's early reaction against both Calvin and Kant left him very suspicious of universal moral principles. He writes, for example, quote, ready-made rules available at a moment's notice for settling any kind of moral difficulty have been the chief object of the ambition of moralists. In the much less complicated and less changing matters of bodily health, such pretensions are known as quackery. One searches in vain through Dewey's work for the sort of abstract principles offered by Kant, Mill, Rawls, and Habermas, and indeed for anything that can happily be described as a moral theory. Dewey might well have agreed with Posner when he writes, quote, academic moralism is incapable of contributing significantly to the resolution of moral and legal issues. Dewey would also have agreed with a meta-ethical view that Posner shares with Nietzsche, Anscombe, and Bernard Williams. As Posner puts it, quote, the only warrant for believing that there is a moral law that is out there is, in the very strong sense claimed by a Plato or an Aquinas, is faith in a supreme lawgiver and in a spiritual reality as real as material reality, unquote. But it is far less clear that Dewey would have inferred, as Posner does, from moral realism being out to moral relativism being in. It depends, obviously, on what you mean by moral relativism. If you mean merely that, as Posner puts it, quote, our modern beliefs concerning cruelty and inequality are contingent rather than being the emanations of a universal law, close quote, then both Hegel and Dewey will count as relativists. So, for that matter, will Rawls. For in this sense, moral relativism is merely the denial that knowledge of something transcultural, something like the will of God or the dictates of pure practical reason, can help us decide between competing systems of social control. But when Posner goes on to say, quote, it is provincial to say that we are right about slavery, for example, and the Greeks wrong, I think Dewey would demur. He would be startled by Posner's claim that, quote, the relativity of morals implies that there is no moral progress flattering to the residents of wealthy modern nations. I think Dewey would respond to Posner by along the following lines. He could say, of course our judgment of our own rightness is provincial, so are all our judgments about anything. But why should we, the fact that we use the criteria of our own time and place to judge that we've made progress, cast doubt on that judgment? What other criteria are available? If you mean simply that only nations as rich and lucky as those of the modern West can get along without slaves, you have a point. But why deny that our wealth and good fortune have enabled us to become morally better? Dewey would, I think, argue that the contingency of our moral outlook, its dependence on material conditions, no more impugns our moral superiority than Galileo's dependence on expensive new optical technology impugned the Copernican theory of the heavens. We can no more help thinking of ourselves as morally superior to our ancestors than we can help believing that our astrophysical theories are better than theirs. Mock modesty about either intellectual or moral progress is an example of what Peirce called make-believe doubt, doubt that has no effect on practice. The line of argument I'm attributing to Dewey marks the point at which I take pragmatism and positivism to diverge. Pragmatists of my persuasion spend a lot of time doing what Posner disparagingly describes as leveling down science. We do this so that science will no longer seem to tower over morality. Posner says of this strategy that it, quote, may succeed in equating scientific to moral inquiry at the semantic level, but it leaves untouched the vast practical difference in the success of these two enterprises, close quotes. I do not see any such difference. We in the modern West know much more about right and wrong than we did two centuries ago, just as we know much more about how nature works. We have been brilliantly successful in both morals and physics. The difference between my view and Posner's reflects my Kuhnian view of scientific inquiry. I see it as working in much the same way as does moral or political inquiry, whereas Posner sees a big difference. He argues that moral philosophy is, as he puts it, epistemically feeble because, quote, the criteria for pronouncing a moral claim valid are given by the culture in which the claim is advanced. Kuhnians like myself replied that the same argument would show the epistemic feebleness of physics and biology. Posner does concede that Kuhn might have had a point. In a long sentence that I'll scrutinize in some detail, he writes, I quote, even if scientific realism is rejected in favor of the view that science yields objective results, objective in scare quotes, yields objective results only because scientists happen to form a cohesive, like-minded community, even if, that is, we accept the view that consensus is the only basis on which truth claims can or should be accepted, because consensus makes truth rather than truth forcing consensus, moral theorists are still up against the brute fact that there is no consensus with regard to moral principles from which answers to contested moral questions might actually be derived. End of quote. Posner is claiming that even if we give up the idea of truth forcing consensus, the crucial difference between science and morals remains. I would rejoin that what remains is only the difference between moral theory and scientific theory. This difference is compatible with saying that morality and physics have made progress in exactly the same way. True beliefs have gradually replaced false beliefs. As I said earlier, I agree with Posner and Dewey that we are never going to get agreement on moral principles from which answers to contested moral questions might actually be derived. We will never have principles that bear on particular cases in the straightforward and uncontroversial way in which physical theory bears on a particular observable events. But that asymmetry between physics and morality does nothing to impugn the existence of moral progress. For both moral and scientific progress are matters of agreement about practices, not about principles. Posner has remarked that even Justice Scalia would now judge the lash and the stocks to be cruel and unusual punishments, even though they were not so regarded by those who drafted the Eighth Amendment. Most of us, and probably Scalia as well, would agree that this change constitutes moral progress. One can agree with Posner that moral philosophy is of no help in providing the courts with reasons for preventing local authorities from using the lash. But that just shows that our judges have become better able to tell cruelty when they see it, even if they can't define it. I suggested earlier that the advantage of pragmatism over positivism is that pragmatists have no trouble with the idea that propositions such as the stocks and the lash are cruel punishments, and there is nothing immoral about sodomy, have recently been discovered to be true. They are true on a pragmatist view in just the same way that it is true that E equals MC squared. The fact that moralities are, among other things, local systems of social control does no more to cast doubts on moral progress than the fact that scientific research is financed by people hoping to get better technology cast doubt on scientific progress. Willingness to level down science in this way is, as I see it, the biggest difference between pragmatism and positivism. So Kuhn was one of the best things that ever happened to pragmatism. His work helped us to accept Dewey's suggestion that reasoning in morals is no different from reasoning in science, a suggestion Posner explicitly rejects. Admittedly, however, this leveling down looks fishy both to common sense and to the majority of analytic philosophers. That's because both are still tempted to say that if a sentence is true, there must be something that makes it true. The physical world, they continue, makes physical theory true, but it's not clear what makes moral judgments true. So the argument goes, perhaps the only value judgments that can be thought of as true are empirical predictions about what means will best serve what ends. Posner seems to accept this line of thought, for he's quick to argue from what he calls our inability to reason about ends to the conclusion that there is no such thing as better apprehension of moral truth. But pragmatists, at least those of my sect, don't think that anything, either the physical world or the consensus of inquirers, makes beliefs true. All that consensus does is to help us recognize moral truth. Pragmatists should cheerfully agree that truths, all kinds of truths, are eternal and absolute. It was true before the foundations of the world were laid, both that 2 + 2 = 4 and that I would be wearing this particular tie today. It's also true that the lash, it was also true that the lash is, in the sense of the Eighth Amendment, a cruel punishment. Eternal and absolute truth is the only kind of truth there is, even though the only way we know what's true is by reaching a consensus that may well prove transitory. All that can be salvaged from the claim that truth is a product of consensus is that finding out what other people believe is, most of the time, a good way to decide what to believe oneself. But only most of the time. If consensus were all we ever had to go on, there would be neither scientific nor moral progress. We should have had neither Galilean mechanics nor the civil rights movement. One of the features of science that Kuhn helped us appreciate is that great leaps forward occur only when some imaginative genius puts a new interpretation on familiar facts. Shelley's defense of poetry helped us appreciate that the same thing is true of morality. As Shelley wrote, quote, "Reason is to imagination as the instrument to the agent, as the body to the spirit, as the shadow to the substance." Dewey endorsed that analogy, and also Shelley's claim that, quote, "the great instrument of moral good is the imagination, and poetry administers to the effect by acting on the cause." Dewey agreed with Shelley when Shelley wrote, quote, "ethical science arranges the elements that poetry has created." In both physical and ethical theory, only the imagination can break through the crust of convention. Galileo did for Aristotle's hylomorphic physics what Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King did for the Southern way of life. He dreamed up an alternative. The attractiveness of that alternative shattered an old consensus and built up a new one. Posner's label for people like Parks, King, and Catherine MacKinnon is moral entrepreneur. Posner is quite ready to acknowledge that if it were not for these entrepreneurs, we should still be sentencing criminals for the lash, segregating the water fountains, and enforcing the anti-sodomy laws. But his positivistic leanings are apparent in his description of how these entrepreneurs get their job done. Of MacKinnon, he writes, quote, her influential version of radical feminism is not offered without supporting arguments, but her influence is not due to the quality of these arguments, it is due to her polemical skills, her single-mindedness, her passion. In another passage, Posner writes, "Moral entrepreneurs persuade, but not with rational arguments. They use non-rational means of persuasion." Posner's positivism takes another form when he tries to explain the success of these entrepreneurs by saying that they are, quote, "like arbitrageurs in the security market, they spot the discrepancy between the existing code and the changing environment and persuade the society to adopt a new, more adaptive code." I think that Dewey would have found this analogy with the arbitrageur misleading and perhaps a bit repellent, whereas Posner is dismissive of moral idealism, Dewey reveled in it. It seems to me more in accord with Shelley's and Dewey's account of moral progress to think of Martin Luther King, Betty Friedan, and the leaders of the gay rights movement as creating, rather than detecting, a changed environment. They changed it by single-mindedly and passionately telling us about the damaged lives caused by present social arrangements. They incited social hope by proposing programs of action and prophesying a better future. These so-called non-rational methods worked. Posner's notion of adaptation seems to me to do nothing to explain why these entrepreneurs succeeded. Posner has set things up so that moral idealists can't look good. For if they try to avoid non-rational persuasion by appealing to abstract principles, they're being disingenuous. They're ignoring the Wittgensteinian point, of which Stanley Fish has made so much, that no rule can determine its own interpretation. The more resoundingly universal a moral or legal principle is, the more flexible its application. But on the other hand, if the romantic idealists refrain from citing such principles and from giving arguments, giving deductive arguments inferring from those principles, Posner will tell them that they have abandoned rational argumentation in favor of non-rational strategies. Posner draws an invidious contrast between heroic figures like Mill and Nietzsche, whom he admires, and what he calls modern moral philosophers such as Rawls, Dworkin, Ruz, and Scanlon, about whom he's less enthusiastic. He says that the latter are not a likely source of moral entrepreneurship. But Posner, again, I think, is setting things up so that his opponents are damned no matter what they do. The more unlike Nietzsche and McKinnon Rez, Scanlon, and the rest are, the more useless, the more like them, the less rational. Consider the following conundrum. Is Posner's own attempt to stigmatize various sorts of advocacy as non-rational itself an example of rational argumentation or a polemical strategy? I have no idea how to answer that question and see no point in trying to do so. For I would say about criteria of rationality what Posner says about moral principles, namely, they are just the fancy dress of workaday social norms that vary from society to society. In the 16th century, for example, it was only rational to test astrophysical and biological theories against scripture. We can rightly claim to be more rational than most of Copernicus's contemporaries, if that means simply that our beliefs about what to test against what, and more generally of what is relevant to what, are true, whereas many of their beliefs about relevance were false. But that's just another way of saying our social norms are better than their social norms. Most of us do not read Genesis literally and would oppose bringing back the lash and the stocks. We've made progress on both fronts. But there's no neutral, non-parochial standpoint to which we can repair to show that we've done so. Our judgments of progress and of rationality will remain as parochial as our judgments of everything else. But the parochial, historically conditioned character of justification is entirely compatible with the eternal and absolute character of truth. Dewey saw no point in dividing the various tactics we use to persuade our fellow citizens into the rational ones and the others. What difference in practice, one can imagine him asking, is this difference supposed to make? The question of whether it was rational to let Galilean mechanics undermine Christian faith, or whether that was the result of passionate, irrational Holbachian and Voltairean polemic, does not seem worth raising. Neither does the question of whether the suffragettes achieved victory through the use of reason or by virtue of passionate single-mindedness. Again, consider Posner's claim that, quote, at its best, moral philosophy, like literature, enriches it neither proves nor edifies. Well, what follows? What does it matter whether we say with Posner that, moral philosophers are poets and novelists manqués, or say instead that poets and novelists are amateur moral theorists? We know the sorts of things that moral philosophers, poets, novelists, economists, and lawyers have achieved, and we know how they did it. We're in a position to evaluate their contributions to culture and to consider how they might best make further contributions. Is any purpose served by separating them into rational sheep and non-rational goats? Posner seems to think that such separation is essential to doing good sociology. Sociology, he tells us, is the scholarly niche that his book on moral and legal theory occupies. He describes himself there as, quote, deploying Weberian insights concerning professionalization and its alternatives, including charismatic moral entrepreneurship. And as he also describes himself as skeptical about knowledge claims advanced by various academic disciplines, saying that such skepticism is a leitmotif of sociology. But adopting, end of quote from Posner, but adopting a Kuhnian view of scientific progress, replacing epistemology of science with history and sociology of science, has not encouraged skepticism about the knowledge claims made by physicists, nor should it. For it was only invidious contrast between natural science and the rest of culture, the contrast that was at the heart of positivism, that made possible skepticism about moral entrepreneurs and talk of epistemic feebleness. From a Kuhnian perspective, Weberian skepticism looks like just one more strategy employed by self-interested professional sociologists hoping to carve out a niche for themselves within the academy. It would be silly to think that the stunning news that some Nobel Prize winners in physics and biology are self-interested and devious academic politicians impugns their claims to have discovered new truths. It seems equally wrong to think that Dworkin's sometimes exaggerated claims for academic moral philosophy give us reason to doubt that Rawls has added to our stock of moral truths. The aggressive tactics of bulldogs like Huxley and Dworkin should not be held against the people whose newly discovered truths they hope to disseminate. Nor should one infer epistemic feebleness from the fact that, as things are presently going, Rawls' work is impotent to advance the cause of social justice. That would be like inferring the epistemic feebleness of Darwin's theory from the increasing popularity of creationism. The main reason that positivism still seems attractive and pragmatism counterintuitive, I think, is our resistance to the idea that criteria of rationality are just the fancy dress of workaday social norms. This resistance is the product of the passionate, single-minded polemics of entrepreneurs such as Descartes, Bacon, and Locke. They attempted to substitute a quasi-deity called reason for the Christian God, and thus to make the word irrational do the work previously done by unchristians. Among the tactics they employed was an insistence that relations of relevance between propositions are non-contingent and non-local, and that an innate ability called reason combined with a moral virtue called intellectual honesty will make such relations evident. To think that Genesis is relevant to biology, we are told, is to be either irrational or dishonest, and the same goes for believing Leviticus to be relevant to gay marriage. But reading Kuhn leads one to realize that criteria of relevance, and thus of rationality, are social norms resting on nothing more than consensus. Pragmatism is compatible with the claim that consensus can change both for the better and for the worse. All it denies is that we can judge whether we're advancing or regressing by assuming an Archimedean position outside the contingencies of history. That position would be one from which one could compare our sentences with the things that make them true or false. To deny that there is such a relation as being made true by is to deny that there could be any such position. Pragmatists argue, in addition, that even if there were such a relation, we should only be entitled to invoke it if there were a consensus about whether it held. Nothing except consensus can validate the claims of a purportedly consensus-independent standpoint. So the pragmatists conclude we might as well stick to achieving first-order consensus in physics and morals and forget about second-order consensus on such philosophical topics as the existence and location of unmediated relations between the human mind and reality. I've been arguing in this lecture that Posner's refusal to admit that we have made moral progress is too much like Nietzsche's condescending attitude toward human hopes. Both seem to me rhetorical gestures that have no bearing on practice. For moral progress is not an idea we could possibly get out of our heads. The idea that the human future might be morally better than the human past is not one we could have genuine doubts about. Let me conclude by illustrating this point with one more example. Consider Posner's claim that if he had been a colonial official in India under the Raj, he would have forbidden sati because he found it disgusting, not because he found it immoral. He explains that although, quote, we tend to find deviations from our own morality disgusting, those reactions, quote, prove nothing about the wrongness of the disgusting morality. Posner asked us to imagine someone saying, I find it disgusting that these widows are expected to burn themselves alive, but I have no idea whether this practice is morally wrong. That stance seems to me as artificial and as irrelevant to action as the one affected by the sort of philosopher whom Hilary Putnam has dubbed a metaphysical realist. Philosophers of this sort are the ones who say, I'm certain that my assertion will survive all challenge, that it will remain justifiable to any audience, any time, but I have no idea whether it's true. Metaphysical realists try to disjoin truth from any possible human activity. Posner, it seems to me, tries to do the same to the notion of moral rightness. But that sort of disjunction is just what Dewey wanted to avoid. Once we give up the attempt to see things under the aspect of eternity, we are left with nothing except the hope that we will look good to our future selves or to future generations. Dewey thought that that hope was enough. Thank you.
Okay, we have about half an hour before we adjourn to the reception. Let me remind you all that you're all invited to a reception immediately following the question period.
Yeah.
You came just to the edge of saying that the success of a moral entrepreneur could be somehow explained by their moral rightness. You said of Hunter that he had no way to account for the success of Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King because he disjoined their particular reforms of social norms from moral truth. You're shaking your head vigorously enough that I would just like to ask, what is it that you meant then by saying that, what is it you think you can explain about their success that Posner cannot? And how is it that you think that their success teaches us anything about the reality or unreality of moral truth?
I don't think anything could teach us anything about the reality or unreality of moral truths. I don't, as Dewey said, reality is a term of value or choice. I'm in favor of truth, so if you like, I can say, yeah, moral truths are real. But it adds nothing whatever to saying, I believe that the following are some moral truths. All I said about Posner and the moral entrepreneur's success was that he couldn't explain it by adaptation to a changed environment. And it seems to me that the careers of moral entrepreneurs show the environment changing because they did what they did, rather than they're adapting to previous causes. But I haven't got any explanation for their success. That is, I don't know why gay rights came along 20 years ago instead of 50 years ago. I don't know what it was in, you know, society, in the economy, in whatnot that made it possible. I don't know why Galilean physics came along in the 17th century rather than the 14th century either. Does that speak to what you were asking?
Do you think that from the fact of a moral entrepreneur's success, we can infer something about their being, as it were, moral rather than immoral entrepreneurs? That they've shifted, that the fact that the gay rights movement succeeded tells us that it was right that it succeeded?
No more than the fact that the National Socialist movement succeeded shows anything about them. You can never infer from success to rightness. You can never infer from anything straight to either truth or rightness. Life would be simpler if we had criteria for truth and rightness other than entrepreneurship of the in the manner of Galileo and the gay rights movement. But we don't. That's the Shelleyan point about the imagination.
No. Doesn't your position imply that there is some kind of, I don't want to call it platonic ideal, but that there is some kind of better as opposed to a worse in morality, that it isn't just a question of contemporary habit?
Well, I think before Plato loused things up by introducing the notion of objectivity into the area, we all thought that some moral judgments were true and others were false. We also thought Athenian society was better than Scythian society and so on. Plato then said, how come there can be true moral judgments? What makes them true? And we've been worried about that ever since. Dewey suggested we not worry about that anymore, that we just go along with the common person in the street and say, yeah, there is truth and falsity in morals as elsewhere. And you would only think so if you were interested in praising some other area of culture as somehow superior to morality, like, for instance, theology or physics.
But then, what is it that allows any kind of progress, if you're even calling that? Or what is it that allows people to say, this really is wrong, even if it was okay in the past? What's the referent?
If you ask what causes them to say that instead of what allows them to say that, the answer would be obvious. All the stuff that's happened in history between us and them. If you ask what allows them, you're already asking for an Archimedean point, rising above history and saying, you know, don't just tell me the causes, tell me the reasons, where reasons mean attaching to a skyhook that is immune from the contingencies of history. That's what Plato did for us. He tempts us to ask for that kind of skyhook. And I see Dewey as doing his best to rid us from the impulse.
That pragmatism is a method may, well, to me it seems very similar to something like reflective equilibrium as a method. And I was wondering if you could speak to the relation between the two methods and whether that, if they are similar, that may cause Rawls to be a pragmatist, perhaps despite himself.
I guess I never found much use for the notion of method, either the pragmatic method or the method of reflective equilibrium. I mean, to say that Rawls practiced a method of reflective equilibrium is just to say, crudely, he balanced some of the theoretical statements in the philosophers against some of the intuitions of the people in the street and, you know, came out with something trying to do justice to both. Well, of course, he wasn't the first one to do that. Everybody has always done exactly that. I don't see he picked out anything special when he talked about reflective equilibrium. And I don't think Dewey picked out anything special when he talked about the scientific method. One of my favorite passages in Dewey is when Carnap and the positivists asked him to write for the Encyclopedia of Unified Science an article on scientific method, he praised the chauffeur as an excellent paradigm of the scientific method. That was not what Carnap had in mind.
In a nutshell, my question would be, why aren't you given all that you said this afternoon, indeed a metaphysical realist, but without any skepticism connected with it at all. What I mean is the following, that you said, and I think this is quite right, that in both, let's say, physics and in morals, we judge truth according to the standards at our disposal, the standards that are in various ways marked by our place in history, time and place. And so we have only the standards at our disposal. You disagree with someone, the position you attributed to Richard Posner, when it comes to morals, someone who says, well, if we're only judging by our contemporary standards, how can we claim that what we're judging to be morally right really is morally right? You wanted to say, well, indeed, we can say it's morally right, precisely in the way in which when we judge questions about physical nature, we rely upon the standards at our disposal, and there's no reason why we shouldn't hesitate to say that beliefs that meet those standards that we now have at our disposal are indeed true. So why not say that in both morals and in physics, the things that we judge by our present standards are indeed true. True, as you yourself said, timelessly so. The standards we use are bound up in our time and place, but the truths that we judge, be it in physics or in morals, are timelessly true. Yeah. That looks like metaphysical realism, except that you don't want to be you don't want to allow the particular version of metaphysical realism, which says the following. Truth is timeless. We have only our time-bound standards. So how could we ever claim that judging things by our time-bound standards gives us timeless truth? That's the kind of skeptical metaphysical realist that you've, as we're associated with the title metaphysical realist. But I think you actually are, compliment you for being, I think you're right to be, a metaphysical realist in another sense, which is that you were quite willing to say, quite frankly, we use time-bound standards to judge what's timelessly true, be it in morals and for physics. Why isn't that metaphysical realism?
I guess it just isn't. I mean, Putnam defined the term in such a way that the metaphysical realist had to be a skeptic. That he set him up in that way. It seems to me you're giving it a new sense.
I won't get involved in Putnam philology, but when he did that, he did it by saying that truth as we actually should understand it, internal realism, is truth in something less than the timeless sense. That is, truth as judged by consensus or what would be assertable under ideal conditions or all that sort of stuff, which is not what you really want to say.
I never understood what Putnam meant by internal realism. He lately has said he didn't either.
Yeah.
I don't want to be any kind of realist because it suggests that there's an interesting question about realism versus anti-realism. And that suggests that there's an interesting question about which true sentences are made true by the world and what true sentences are not made true by the world. If you don't believe that anything is made true by anything, you don't want to raise the question. If you do raise the question, you will find yourself making a distinction between realism about X and anti-realism about Y. I don't much care whether you are realist or anti-realist, as long as you're the same for every sentence and every area of discourse. But if you are, then there's no point in using either term, because the terms were invented to make a contrast between sentences or discourse.
This is a question about whether these remarks get to the heart of Posner's brand of pragmatism. And prompted by your remark about Leo Strauss and the claim that utility and truth aren't the same, and we do we thought they were, I think Posner's version of pragmatism says, with respect to a cell phone, we know whether it's useful. We have a criterion we can point to with respect to smoking and occupational illness. We know we can connect causes to harms. And I think what's in his book is for things like gay rights or feminism, what utility calls for, what works. There isn't it's hard to figure out what's meant by that. That's what's behind it, I think. And when you talked about gay rights, you said, well, we think this. But with cell phones, it's not just that we think this. We see it in a way that it's not clear we see with respect to gay rights, or is it? When you talked about Rosa Parks and racial equality, it wasn't what you were saying with gay rights, I don't think, or at least it was less explicit. You said there was damage to persons. Something like that, used the word damage. And that would suggest some kind of account of how we would know what works. It isn't just what we see. Now, I'm not sure what's behind, maybe you think nothing's behind the notion of damage to persons, but at least I thought you might have a consequentialist or utilitarian account or something which would make the word damage, it's the concept intelligible, we know what it was and we know why it was bad. And that, I think, is the correct direction to go, and that's how to be Posner, I think, rather than by saying that what we believe with respect to science is no different from what we believe with respect to morals, because he says with respect to science, a cell phone or a computer, what works is not just a matter of consensus, but it's a matter of something else.
And you agree with him, or?
I do, in the following, I agree with you and not him on the conclusion, but I think the answer is not the line of analogies, but it's instead an account. And I thought you got at it with the damage to persons, the account, which does the same work, I guess, as the tacit account that we rely on when we see a cell phone working, or when we agree that smoking makes people sick.
Let me try to put the matter in somewhat different terms. Why is it easier to get agreement in science and technology than in morals?
I don't think it always is. It depends, as Gorth showed, it depends on the, right, with respect to some scientific questions, there's more dispute than there are with respect to some moral.
Okay, but why do people like Posner take it for granted that science is an area in which you get lots of consensus and morals is an area in which you don't, which by and large is true, at least in our society? No?
I don't think it's true. I think it depends on the level of generality with which we describe the question. If you ask, is quantum mechanics right, people would be very puzzled to try to answer that, and probably not in agreement. Whether Darwin is right is disputed. With respect to slavery, that one's gone. There's more consensus on the wrongness of slavery or the wrongness of torture than there is on many scientific questions.
This is getting too complicated. Some other too many issues. Let me try again to say a position and see what you think. It seems to me that the relative ease of getting people to say quantum physics must be true because it gave us the atomic bomb, or there must be electrons because look at my cell phone, or Darwin must be right because I understand that without these stem cells I never would have been cured of what's this. We want science to help us predict and control stuff. We have faith that all this stuff about quantum physics and evolution is what enables us to get what we want, namely prediction. Recently in the modern secular West, as Judith Sklar said, cruelty has become the prime sin, and everything political is judged by reference to does it produce unnecessary suffering. Well, my view is that predictability and control in science and avoidance of unnecessary suffering in morals are choices made by the modern West. Choices I have no objection to, but choices of the same sort. You can imagine societies, the Chinese of the 17th century,
were told about Galileo by the Jesuits and so on. You can imagine societies who didn't think science had much to do with prediction and control. You can imagine societies, you know, societies in which morality doesn't have much to do with it whatsoever. So,
I mean, when Posner says we don't argue about ends, I'm inclined to say, yeah, we do. We argue with the Chinese about science, and we argue with the ancient world about slavery, gay rights, and whatnot. The arguments are complicated, but they're the same arguments in both. But I take it you think that analogy misses.
I think it's right. I think the answer to Posner depends, I'm not sure you like this, on some sort of account, such as minimizing suffering is good. There would be some kind of override to that goal. But that is, if you have something like a utilitarian account or...
Or if you have something like the right passages in the Christian scriptures, for that matter. I mean, I don't much care whether you quote the Gospels or quote Mill. I mean, so long as you can convince people to minimize unnecessary suffering. But I don't see that either offers an account. They're just, you know...
I think this is what Posner challenged really is on gay rights or segregation. The minimization of unnecessary suffering is something that he says is too feeble. Because whether it's unnecessary suffering is the question.
I want to put in parallel the moral entrepreneur is making vivid to us, saying, you know, look, they're suffering, and here's a future in which they don't, so it's unnecessary. This seems to me on all fours with the physicist saying to us, you know, look, here's something that the old theory can't explain. Here's something my theory can explain, you know, so my theory is better. But that's common ground. Yeah.
I was just going to say, they talk about poetic truth and rational truth, and they mean different things. Why not just throw out the word truth? That is...
If you try to throw it out, you lose your audience.
Let me ask you a simple question about theology. And there's the Taliban who stone people during the halftime of a football game for fornication, and it's based on their law, the Sharia, on the Quran. And we very quietly and in private use a lethal injection with the same result, but it's not as disgusting as stoning somebody. Is one or the other more or less moral?
Yeah. And we'll find out when the moral entrepreneurs have done their work on both sides.
I wanted to ask you how much really hangs on your use of the notion of progress. It looked like when you were trying to take science out of its special position and make it look more like ethics, you were saying that just as in science we understand more and more, so too in ethics we understand more and more, and your examples were good ones for that, feminism and gay rights and so on. But it seems to me that that's probably not going to work across the board, that in science, even, however puny in the picture, we really do have something like a notion of lurching progress and understanding. But in ethics, there's some large areas where, I mean, let's say, take the treatment of animals. The ancient world understood a great deal more about that than we currently understand. And you can give an account of why that was, understanding was lost, because in the middle there was a metaphysics that told us we were above nature and we were separate from the rest of nature. So the Judeo-Christian tradition blotted out a kind of understanding of the commonality with other animals in respect of suffering that we used to have. Now, I guess I think that that means that it's not very safe to rely for your... I don't want to say debunking of science, but the despecializing of science on this parallel with respect to progress, unless you have something more like Cass's deeper account, in which case you could say, well, we've made progress in that we understand more and more about pain, and that's why now we can look at our current treatment of animals and begin to, as it were, recover some parts of the lost understanding that we didn't have before. So, something to that effect. But I guess I just want to hear you say how much you think rests on this notion of progress in your argument.
It seems to me you're using a notion of progress in which it always happens. It's inevitable. You know, the later is always the better. I was just using progress as what we think we've made, what we can't help but think we've made. You know, we may be wrong, but we have to think of ourselves as making progress. We have to think of the future as being capable of being made morally better than it's been.
Couldn't it be quite important to see that we've declined from something that we did once understand? Now, of course, you're right to say the person who sees that is going to think that that's already an achievement, and that other people should see that too, and that would be progress. But I guess I think there's still an asymmetry between science and ethics in that respect, that in ethics we're all the time trying to recover pieces of understanding that have been lost or eclipsed, and that's certainly one of the things that Nietzsche was most perceptive about, the need to do that. Whereas in science, that doesn't, I can't think of a major case like that where we think, oh, there's a whole piece of physical reality we just completely neglected, and now we have to recover that.
I guess I don't think of much ethical thought as a matter of we must recover. Dewey didn't. I mean, he was not interested in recovering anything from the past. He just wanted us to be imaginative enough to create a future hitherto undreamt of. And it seems to me that's the more efficient method of moral progress.
Well, but sometimes you might need to recognize that certain things that you've bought into are impediments to good thought. And that's certainly what Nietzsche thought about Christianity.
Well, that's what Dewey called breaking the press of convention.
Yeah.
But he thought the way to do it was not by saying, did we miss something back then, but by saying, could we do it better next time?
But, I mean, I guess I think you're on safer ground if you can say, well, what's wrong is the pain that animals are caused, and that's something that was always there. It isn't that we exactly have made progress in identifying a new consideration, but we just now have dispelled some obstacles to our understanding of the salience of that, which were created, let's say, by the Judeo-Christian tradition. So that would be a much more complicated story about progress.
And I guess I think it's an unnecessary story. I mean, I think stories about once we saw in glass darkly, but now we see clearly, you know, once we were trapped in appearance, but now we see reality, don't really do much for us. What does it for us is to say, look how we could do things if we use the new physical theory, if we follow the moral entrepreneur, look ahead. Don't worry what was real and what was apparent. And that one way to put the big pragmatism versus Platonism contrast is just to say reality versus appearance was a really bad distinction. We don't need it.
So I tend to think that there are possibly different shades of your argument, and I kind of see it in kind of a two-by-two table, but the one shade would be that we have to believe that science is like morality, and the other is that, well, you could actually see some differences, and nevertheless still buy a Kuhnian way of thinking about both science and morality. And so I think picking up a little bit on Cass's idea of the cell phone, but I mean, you think of scientific predictability, right? It was the ability to predict a future event that in some sense is often what validates a scientific theory, or at least in the eyes of...
Since the 17th century.
Yeah, right. And there just doesn't seem to be the same metric way of doing that in morality. The ability to kind of just predict a physical event, a
is going to happen in the future. Now, but I don't think that even if one saw those distinctions between normal scientific knowledge and normal moral knowledge, that you necessarily would have to give up on the whole idea that there is something very similar between those two. And then along that line, in terms of kind of Hunian normality, you could have one idea of it as simply being, it is the consensus. Normal science is the consensus. The moral agreement about torture or about gay rights is the consensus that now exists, and that's the language of normal morality that we talk about now. Versus something Hunian where we think that, and it's actually better than the previous state of normal moral thinking at the time, which requires some notion of progress. And so what I'm wondering is, do I need to, can I leave today thinking that, well, there's something about physical sciences that is different than morality, and yet still buy your argument about taking a Hunian approach to moral progress, and also skip the idea of progress, or would I, in some sense, would I just not be? Would I be misinterpreting what you are trying to tell me I should believe in some sense?
I sort of, I lost you at some point. Okay. Why do you want to give up the notion of progress?
Excuse me?
Why do you want to give up the notion of progress?
Because it could be that we could have normal moral discourse that was different from, as in normal science, right? That was different from 200 years ago, and yet not necessarily, and view it as a new consensus formation, etc. And view it, but not necessarily view it as necessarily progress.
Well, we could, if we never had to make any decisions ourselves, but could just act as spectators. When we ask, whose side am I on? You know, the ancients or the moderns, you do. I think Stanley Fish made a good point when he said there are no relativists in practice. As a practical matter, nobody is a relativist. You can't stand back from a moral decision and say, well, I recognize that there is a consensus, but I have no idea whether it's a good consensus or not. You have a moral outlook. All the stuff about epistemic feebleness doesn't make the slightest difference to what you do on the basis of that moral outlook.
And so that would be a difference between just kind of describing the situation and actually being a part of it?
Yeah, you can describe science, modern Western high-class cell phone type science, as just a flash in the pan, which will doubtless be succeeded by some other form of understanding of the world. You can, but you still want to use your cell phone. You're going to take sides. You can't be a relativist about physical science to that extent. You can't be a relativist about torture when asked to go torture somebody. I take it what Dewey was trying to do is to say this whole absolute versus relativist thing, like the appearance versus reality thing, just puts the emphasis on how things would look from an ideal point of view. But since there is no ideal point of view, why don't we just forget about those distinctions and get on with the difference between the present and the future, which is all the great big philosophical distinction we need.
We don't have to have any, I'm saying we don't have to have any criteria other than looking toward the future.
both science and morals are so complicated, so much a product of the current state of scientific and moral discussion, that there is just no hope that a philosopher will tell you what criteria you are applying when you choose to believe in quantum mechanics, or what criteria you're applying when you decide you're in favor of gay rights. The notion of criteria gets no grip here.
I want to make two statements. I think there are two claims that I picked out from the comments, one from the speech and the second from the answers. I'm more interested in the second part, but I made it so obviously wrong with the first that you let the speech. So the first major claim I picked out is that you can rule out the ruling out of moral progress without some kind of opinion form. That's the ad hoc position. But I think you made a much more robust point in the answers, which is that maybe this is the plan, that it is useful to believe we have made moral progress. And that would certainly fit with the pragmatic tradition. But that claim, that's the claim you want to make, is so far not defended, and to me, not necessarily intuitively attractive in any way. It may well be that human motivation is such that seeing a decline is actually a way of maintaining promoting progress. So, first, is that completely wrong? And second, even if it is wrong, which is.
It is wrong.
Yeah, I've gotten you wrong. What's your response to those who text me?
I did quote Strauss on utility, but I didn't actually say anything about utility in the talk, because I don't think that there is a criterion called utility that anybody knows how to apply. So I don't think it. You know, my argument was not, it's useful to believe we have made moral progress. It's that as agents, we can't help but think we've made moral progress.
How can you support that?
Asking the audience to perform thought experiments. We live in an age in which the lash and the socks are no longer used and the anti-sodomy statutes are no longer enforced. Isn't that progress?
Lots of people saying that. Lots of people saying that, not a large percentage, but the end is not zero.
They're wrong, right?
And I can't but believe that.
I guess all I can say is people who think that Darwin was not scientific progress are wrong. There are a great many of them. They may be the majority. They may take over and so on. They're still wrong. In exactly the same sense, the people who thought that sodomy was wrong were wrong. We've made progress. Darwin was progress. The idea of to judge that we have made progress is to take an attitude toward the course of human events. To ask for a criterion, be it utility or anything else, is to try to rise above human events and inspect it from some non-human point of view.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
The lash and the socks example is very odd, I think, very odd. Because we used to put lash people and put them in stocks. Now we put them in cages like animals. Why is that progress? Especially since, you know, now there's a lot of interest and actual return in some cases to shaming penalties, very much like in stocks. So it seems to be a very debatable and ambiguous example of moral progress.
I don't think it's. I mean, it's certainly debatable, but how about this? There's more and more willingness to say you mustn't treat human beings like animals. Lashing them is treating them like animals. Putting them in cages is treating them like animals. Our prisons are now rather less like cages than they used to be. And the prisons in the United States are less like cages than the prisons in most other countries. You know, this is called progress.
But if you visited the prison and seen the prisoners with their sort of arms hanging out of the bars, you would you would think you were in a zoo. And there are 2 million people there. So it's kind of, I make the point because it struck me, listening to you, there's a kind of self-congratulatory tone to talking about moral progress. Whereas it seems to me people are, we're the same as we've always been ever since we were monkeys. And the difference is, because of wealth and because of knowledge, we manipulate, we exploit, and achieve our ends in different ways. But I don't think it makes us better than, I don't think I'm a better judge, because an 18th century judge would be sentencing people to stocks or, you know, being drawn and quartered. Just different circumstances give rise to different methods of coercion and
well, there is certainly a, you know, as far as explanation goes, there's a perfectly good story to tell without reference to moral progress. You can explain the causal factors that created the difference between this function and that, this crazy and that, and so on. What's missing is whatever it is that has transformed civilization, which wasn't just increasing wealth, it was also moral idealism. I mean, there had to be people who said, this is disgusting, we can't do it anymore. There had to be romantics. When we've argued about this in the past, you said, romanticism, visionary is not really your thing. It was Dewey's thing. And I think that it's a precious thing to hold on to. The idea that we're not just responding to circumstances, we're also using our imagination to make ourselves different. So we really aren't just doing the same kinds of things that monkeys did, not because we're in touch with an immaterial world, but because we have imagination and the monkeys did.
Okay, well, at this point, we're going to thank Professor Gordy very, very much.